Ready?
The light, the torch,
on your
phone. Oh, wow, thanks. Yeah, I used it as my flashlight. Let's see. What's the matter with you?
And invite
them home. Okay, there we go. Oh, that's it. Dear Radha, we as a Sangha have decided to skip.
Cheese.
To skip dairy products from now to honor you and the value of ahimsa. Can you please talk more about ahimsa? Well, I think I've said before that ahimsa as a negative non-injury is very, very broad, and that's why sometimes the negative is good, because so many things can fall under such a blanket statement as non-injury. Whereas if you say something positive, like a positive statement that might act as equivalent, that's only kind of one thing, and there could be many other words that can be an equivalent if it's positive. But the positive statement that I like is a positive statement for ahimsa is kindness. I think I really started realizing that that was the word that was meaningful to me when I saw the Dalai Lama's bumper sticker. The Dalai Lama said in the bumper sticker, kindness is my religion. And, you know, there's a beautiful truth to that, you know, in terms of a sadhana or a way of being or a value or a dharma, certain dharma of how to approach the world in terms of putting ahimsa into a positive statement. And that was the statement that he chose, because he also knows this, you know, the kind of dharmic triangle, like what is there at the top under which all the other things fall and broaden and broaden and broaden. And that is what's normally put at the top is ahimsa. So he knows that too. All of the different traditions know that. But he didn't say ahimsa is my religion. Maybe because most people would not know what it meant. So he chose a positive term. You know, and so if you think of that positive term as something that you can actually because I teach, you know, at the university, so we're people always have to write dissertations. So when they're writing some sort of dissertation, you say, well, how do you operationalize that? You know, how do you operationalize that concept? You know, if it's a research, it's like qualitative or quantitative research, how do you take that value and actually put it into practice, you know, or operationalize it? So how do you operationalize ahimsa? You know, that's too broad of a word, really, for a practice, in a sense. It seems that way to me. Whereas kindness, you know, has a meaning that you really know, and that depth of the meaning keeps increasing and increasing and increasing. You know? And all of the other words kind of branch out of it. So it's a really good, it's a word that makes for a very good sadhana. And if kindness doesn't mean I'm just accepting everything as it is, are going along with everything because you want to be kind. But you can also put up certain boundaries and, you know, you can do so many things in a kind way. We don't really sometimes understand that we can kindly say no, you know, and because it can be problematic, a lot of us can have trouble saying no to people that you let up all this angst and all this irritation and agitation build up and build up until finally you say no, you know. Whereas if you know how to say no in a kind way, like Swamiji, my Swamiji, I'm sure Bhagishananda also, is such a wonderful, he's a wonderful person in so many ways. Anyway, I think I like him so much. But anyway, Swamiji, my Swamiji, was like the embodiment of kindness. That's why Swami Chinmayananda named him Dayananda Saraswati. And Dayananda, Daya means compassion, actually. And some of Swami Chinmayananda's students and devotees, you know, who are also very close to Swamiji, they got on him. Why did you name him Dayananda Saraswati? There's already a very, very famous Dayananda Saraswati. Who is? It's true. If you look Dayananda Saraswati up in the dictionary, you'll get this other guy first. He was very instrumental in establishing Dharma, I think, in various things. There's all kinds of write-ups on him. So they didn't like that Swamiji was named after somebody who's already very famous, you know. So they complained to Swami Chinmayananda about this. And so Swami Chinmayananda said, "What can I do? He is compassion." What can I do? He is compassion. Yeah, that is his name. And it's true. That is who, you know, just endless kindness, endless compassion. Yeah. And so that's reminded me of that story. So when we think of ahimsa in terms of kindness or compassion or some as one of your deepest values, you know, to not bring pain in the world, to as much as you possibly can avoid it, can avoid the unavoidable, but we do as much as we can. And to the degree that you keep growing in that value so that actually you live up to it more and more and more, because it starts as a very deep value, and then you find that you're able to actually operationalize that value, that you actually find yourself that you are more kind than you were last year or last month, and that you do have more compassion, and you feel that your heart is getting bigger. You know, that's a wonderful feeling, you know, because when you're kind to somebody, then you also feel the kindness, you know. If you love somebody, you feel the love. If you're compassionate to somebody, you feel the compassion. If you're angry at somebody, you feel the anger. If you hurt somebody, you feel the hurt. And so you actually kind of immediately get back what you give, you know. And so ahimsa is as at the top of the Dharma triangle. And so if you put on there as... maybe we'd like kindness or compassion. I like kindness better than compassion because compassion is more restricted a little bit. Then you are really held by, just with that one word, you're so much held by Dharma, and it brings so much shanti and peace and love to your mind, because kindness is a type of love. You know, it's a different, it may be different, but nevertheless it is a type of love, and so then you're mind gets to have the love that you give. So I'm just a teacher that, you know, you immediately get what you give. It's like a secret, you know. Whatever you want from others, you give that. He told me that once, you know. What you want from others, you give that. And he said he learned that when he was young, because he had lost his father, and so he didn't get a lot of support of his own life situation. There was just a lot of... he didn't get individual support, really. But he discovered that's kind of the love that he wanted. He got it by giving. He said, well, you want something new, you give that. And then you get it immediately. And he said, and the great thing about that, in so many words, he said, the wonderful thing about that is you have some control over that. Mm. You don't really have control over other people being kind to you or giving you what you want. They may not. They may not even think of it. You know, so you can go waiting for somebody, you know, to give this kindness and love to you. But if you give it yourself, then you have it right away, you know. And so it just becomes a value. It's really your own self-interest. All these values, the value of values, are just your own self-interest. It's like that's what Swamiji's book is really saying. This is why you do this. This is why you practice this given value, because it makes you feel strong or whole, you know, or feel the way that you want to be. And so that's, you have to think about that when we're practicing the values, that we're the greatest benefactor of those values. Because as we live those values, we embody those values. It means we experience them. See what I mean? So that's really a wonderful thing. Now, in terms of this, this is actually, it's a really beautiful thing that you're doing to skip dairy products, because in the West, we love dairy products, especially cheese. And cheese and milk and butter and ghee and all of these things, they're such a staple for us. You know, so it is a sacrifice to give those things up, you know. You know, for years, and as I was kind of being with Swamiji in my 20s and 30s and 40s, I would never, and not just me, none of us, we would never wear leather at the ashram. I was vegetarian, probably from a pretty young age, probably around 18. But I had leather bags. I wore leather shoes, and, you know, I thought that, I mean, I didn't even think, you mean to be a vegetarian, I shouldn't be having a leather bag or leather shoes, but all shoes are leather. How can I even find any shoes that aren't leather? You know, I'll have to wear thongs all the time, which is kind of what I do now. You know, but what I'm saying is that I didn't take it that far, you know, but around Swamiji I did, always. I would never wear leather, anything leather in front of him. Also, Swamiji, the very idea of garlic, it just, to him, it smelled so bad, you know, so, and I love garlic. If I'm making a pasta or something, you know, but I loved it, garlic. Even if I'm sauteing up something, I love it, garlic and garlic bread. But, you know, if I was going to be with Swamiji, I would not have garlic. Even if I know that I'm going to see Swamiji, I'm going to have to fly to the India or I'm going to go to the East Coast. If I was in a garlic eating mood that week, I would not do it. I would not have any garlic, because it was so kind of repulsive to him. And when I was vegetarian, I would eat cheese. I liked blue cheese too. Blue cheese is really, you know, it's full of mold and everything. And has this really strong smell. And Swamiji would go, how could anybody eat that blue cheese? It smells so terrible. How could anybody eat that? Yeah. But he's a vegetarian, not a vegan. And I had talked to him about that once, about how can people eat, you know, eat cheese, what do they call paneer? Mm-hmm. You know, like have cheese and so much yogurt and ghee and milk, and, you know, like Madras coffee is milk and cream. When he knows, he knows for sure, he knows, because he's seen it and he's fought against it also, how cruelly the cows are treated. It's unimaginable. We think that it's bad in the West or in the States, it's so awful. It is so awful. And he's fought against that. He knows about it and all of that. And then what they do to the calves, the torture, they're literally tortured. And so how can, and then, of course, I mean, he would never wear leather, but then also to wear the, and it's just, it's such a horror. It's such a horror story, you know, that as you start to realize what is going, what actually is happening behind the scenes to let you have that food, you know, it's too much. It's too much to be able to do it. But in our culture, and of course in India too, in terms of dairy products, we're not allowed to know that. We're not allowed to know that at all. I mean, we're conditioned from a very, very young age that, you know, milk and cheese is part of the pyramid. Meat, milk, cheese is part of the food pyramid that you really need. You need the milk and the cheese for your bones to be strong. If you don't have that milk, if you don't have that milk, which has all that calcium, your bones won't be strong. Drink your milk. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd all have a full glass of milk. Drink your milk for your bones will be strong. We find out now that's in fact very false. But do you think that they're saying, you know, we made a mistake about that? That actually the milk actually robs you of your calcium. That's the exact opposite. I'm sorry we made that mistake. Drink your milk anyway. Yeah. No, there's a lot of marketing going on that has nothing to do with truth or making people really understand how you end up with this food on your plate or this beautiful leather jacket or this beautiful bag or these wonderful boots. You know, we're trained not to think about that or know about it. And so it's very easy just to put the shutters on. You know, and we've done it from childhood. And our parents have done it too. They also have the shutters on. They don't think about it at all. You just go to the store and buy the nicely packaged meat. You go to the shoe store and buy the very expensive leather boots. And you like them that they are leather. These are leather boots. They're not plastic boots. They're leather boots. These are the good boots. You know, this is a real leather bag. This isn't like one of those plastic bags. You know, the plastic bags are cheap. The leather bags, you know, are beautiful and they're sophisticated and they're cool and they're wonderful. We've learned how not to think about how it is that leather bag has become available to you. What the animals have gone through. We don't know. We don't really want to know either. You know, because to Margaret Mead, this is my favorite line. Margaret Mead is a famous anthropologist. She's passed away now, but she's very, very well known in the field. And she has this wonderful statement that people would rather give up their religion than their food. I think it's true. The food is such a comfort for us. You know? And also we have a whole, our social life is built around food, like going out to dinner together, eating together, having a glass of wine together. There's a whole rituals around food. You know? I remember going out with some friends when I was vegan before any restaurants were vegan. We went out to dinner at this nice restaurant. And I was looking at the menu, and I realized, there's nothing here I can eat on this menu. Nothing. There's nothing there. You know? If you give up eggs, you know, eggs, cheese, milk, and of course meat, butter, because everybody cooks with butter, so you give up the butter, give up any kind of yogurt, and this particular restaurant where I didn't know what I was going to eat, and we just decided to go because, well, everybody was a vegetarian, not everybody was a vegan, but if you were a vegan, you're going to have to sit there with your glass of water basically. So what I'm saying is that it's not so true now. There's a lot of vegan in restaurants. There's a lot of vegan dishes, at least in the California and the two coasts in the United States. There's plenty of vegan food. It's a non-issue. But we're not used to it. It's what I'm saying. We have so much culture built around our food, and so the thought of giving it up is, your mind just shuts down and doesn't want to deal with it. You know. So, I mean, I used to also feel, in kind of growing up with Swamiji, is that I was a vegetarian because I believed in it, you know. But it used to really bother me that I didn't feel anything. Like, I believe in being, at that time I wasn't vegan, but I was vegetarian, and I believed that it was wrong to eat meat, you know. And that was when vegetarian only meant not eating meat. You could have eggs, you could have cheese, you could have milk, and then finally, you know, the eggs went. That wasn't really very vegetarian. Anyway, whoops. Anyway, so. But I used to bother me that I didn't feel anything, that it was just a mental value that I followed. But I didn't have, I felt like I should feel love for the animals, or I should feel some sort of compassion. I should have that kind of love that Swamiji would exude toward all beings, really. He really cared, like he didn't want to pick a flower, but you could see that he wasn't trying to show off, oh, I don't pick flowers. It wasn't like that at all. It's that he couldn't do that, you know. And he couldn't just swat a mosquito. If he had to do that, he would catch it and take it outside. But it wasn't just, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to catch the mosquito in my hand and take it outside because I'm a good person that doesn't kill animals. I was a good person who doesn't kill animals. I didn't have the feelings. I used to wonder, what's wrong with me? Why can't I have those feelings? When do those feelings come that Swamiji has? And I'm telling you, I asked that question of myself. So I was 18 or 19 or 20 when I started being vegetarian and all that. But I asked that question of myself for maybe 35 years. And then one day I started feeling something. That's a long time to not have your heart be opened, you know. You should feel something about all of that. But I think that's how deep the conditioning is. And another example of it I see just in myself is that, like my cat and my dog, like cats are carnivorous. They actually don't have the intestinal development to eat anything really but meat. Whereas dogs can be omnivores. They can eat meat and vegetables and other things, but not really. Cats should only be eating meat. I mean, if you go into this study of it. And so dogs are omnivores, so they can eat, you know, grains and all kinds of things, but they also need meat, milk, or whatever. And so with Shweta, I go to the store, I buy him meat, and I feed him the meat. I would never eat it myself, but I have no problem giving it to my dogs, you know, or to my cat. And so the animals are being hurt just as much, you know, being slaughtered and treated cruelly for the meat that the dogs eat or the cats eat as the meat that the people eat. They're still animals that are being tortured. And so I put those blinders on, and I just kind of say to myself, I'm sorry, I can't take the blinders off because I have to feed my dog. What can I say to that, you know? Then I say, well, should I not get a dog? Should I not get a cat? You know? And I can't say that. So no, I am going to have a dog and I am going to have a cat. I'm going to feed them the food they need to have. The only little saving grace I have that's starting to come up there on the horizon is that they're actually starting to make vegan or plant-based meat. And so I am thinking, I'm believing that in a few years there will be plant-based, they're already doing it for humans, but plant-based meat for cats and dogs. And then I'll be relieved of this burden. But as long as I have animals, then I'm going to feed them, meat. But I'm not going to eat meat. And when you start thinking about this issue and you just see your conditioning and, you know, where you're going to draw the line and, you know, I want to say one thing is that when I finally went vegan, and that wasn't until in my 60s, I was vegetarian but not vegan. I used to look at vegan as these people are just radical. Really radicals. And I didn't want anything to do with it. They're just going way too far. I thought they were crazy. Kind of, honestly. I didn't understand it. It seemed too extreme. You know, I don't feel that way at all now. I feel like actually that is how we should eat. You know, and that everybody will kind of grow into that in time. Because as we discover what's really going on behind the scenes, you don't have much choice. Well, you won't be able to eat it. Not even cheese or milk, that's even worse than meat in terms of the torture of the animals. So as you start to know, and that knowledge just starts chopping down the blinders that have been protecting you, you know, and then you don't do it anymore. And I think that there's too much education out there now that you won't be able to withstand the knowledge of what's really going on. And so sooner or later we all will be vegan. And the world is also starting to, and science is also starting to make many plant-based meats so that you don't feel the loss of meat for those people who really care about that. You know, that there's plenty of food options out there, plant-based meats, and you can't really tell the difference. One of my students at CIS is vegan, has been vegan for some time, several years. She had a meeting in parents over for Thanksgiving or something like that, some big dinner she had. And she served them barbecued spare ribs. Have you ever heard of those? Mm-hmm. Barbecued spare ribs? Yeah. They were vegan. But it's like a plant-based meat. She didn't tell anybody that they were. And everybody thought they were eating spare ribs. They could not tell at all. I'm so happy. Anyway. But, you know, that I appreciate this sacrifice because I understand the heart behind it because I did that myself for years with Swamiji, and it's just some sort of respect, you know. There's something really nice about it, so I appreciate it, though I don't require any of you to be vegan. It took me almost my whole life to become vegan, so. But still, there's something beautiful about it, so. Thank you for that offering. Also, you can start to realize that you don't need meat or cheese or milk, but there's so many wonderful foods out there. So anyway, that's the vegan wrap for the evening. Mm-hmm. Oh, here's another vegan thing. Dear Rhonda, we eat vegan not to contribute to animals hurting. We wonder what is the right thing to do here. Should we find that the cheese served in our food comes from sheep, goats, cows that could live a healthy life, feeding their babies? We wonder what to think and how to consider the science's new discoveries related to the emotional, sensible life of plants. Who wants to live as well and have an intelligence as well? How do you please share your thoughts? P.S. was Pooja Swamiji vegan. he was vegetarian, not vegan. And he had no interest in becoming vegan either, because the Indians are gigans. Vegans. Gigan means that they eat ghee. You know, ghee is like a dairy product. So, and I talked to him about that once, and he said, Indians will never give up their milk products, their yogurt, and their curd. It's too much part of their diet. They'll never give that up. You know. And so him just saying that, it wasn't even an issue to be discussed. So I just said, okay. All right. Okay. They're gigans. Yeah. And somebody, several times actually, has asked Swamiji this very question about plants, and it's true. The more we discover about plants and trees, that they do, they have sukshma shariras, you know, traditionally, and they do have a level of consciousness. And like, say, if you're attacking them, they've been, you know, measured, their response is measured through electrodes, and they will have a fear response. And they'll also be relaxed when there's no threat, so that they do respond, and they do want to live. And all beings want to live. That's the truth. So when Swamiji also knows all of that, so when he was asked questions like that, he said, the plants don't run away. The animals do. And we all have to eat something, you know. So they're there for us to, they are our food. You know, that's not to say that they're not living beings, but that they're stable. They're there for us to pick them and to eat them. That was his response. Yes, there may be some logic in it. I think there's a logic in it, and it's also I also know how hard it is to find the line that you're going to draw, because everything is life, and life eats life. But I think if you realized what's going on in industrialized farming, that you wouldn't get near it. It's too horrible. It's too unsanitary. Besides all of that, it's not sanitary. They're finally starting, at least in the States, to not use so many antibiotics and hormones. But they are genetically changing in a terrible way the animals. So that the animals, it's a nightmare. If you see some of these animals that are, like especially the cows and chickens, that are raised for meat, you don't even recognize them. They can't even walk. I mean, it's so horrible. You can't, it's unbearable. You know, and how can you eat it? Eat that much? You're eating suffering. You know, and it's very painful to even think about it. And I think it's good to watch. There's a lot of YouTubes and there's a lot of films on this. There's a lot of things to read. But I just warn everybody to be careful about what you watch, because sometimes they're graphic. And I don't think that's right. It's like gives you a trauma. It's traumatizing to watch it, what is done, you know. It's unbearable, and it's drunk. It gets like a post-traumatic stress disorder. It's such a horrible, horrible thing to watch. It's unbearable. And then to eat something, some animal that has been put through that suffering, you're eating all of that pain also. You know, it's unconscionable. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable, and it is so more than wrong. You can't get near it. So you're sparing yourselves by not seeing those things, but if you see them, you better be ready to be a vegan in the next 10 seconds. In fact, it's over. That's it. It's over. You can't watch it and continue. It's not possible.
A little bit big for me with the bees and honey, because I really have a value for what they do in nature and when you grow things. But I understand there might also be some himsa there.
we were talking about this earlier. I think it depends on the beekeeper. Like say you have a small farm and you have 3 or 4 beehives that you're, what do you call them, the boxes that keep the bees in, and you don't take all of it, you take some of it, and you let them have their natural life. You just take some of it. Like say you have your own cow and you take some of the cow's milk, not all of it. You know, you let the mother have her calf, and so there's some ahimsa there where you let the, you take care of the animals and you let them have their natural life and you take some of what they give you. That's their work on the farm. You can have an attitude like that, and you know it's also that's understandable. And so say if it's a small beekeeper who really cares about her bees, like her babies, they're her bees, and she takes care of them and loves them, he does, and makes sure that they have what they need for their own happy life and their own natural expression. So you honor that and take care of it, and then you take a little of their honey. So that doesn't, I might not do that myself, but it doesn't horrify me at all, you know. And I might even have some of that honey. But if you have a little small farmer who has 1 or 2 cows, or you have a beekeeper who has 3 or 4 hives that she's tending, you know, no harm done. But if you look at how, for commercial honey, how it's industrialized, you know, honey, that is, you know, fills shops all over the United States or all over the world, that is a different story. They do not have time to care about the bees. They just mow them under along with the honey and filter them out. I saw it. I've watched films on it. It's absolutely horrifying, and it's so cruel, and it's so gross, and it's so insensitive. It's another horrible thing, you know. But I would never eat that. Emma sometimes has given me honey as a present to take home from this wonderful little beekeeper that's close by. I don't take that anymore, but I used to take it. I don't take it now because I'm a teacher and I don't want to spread that message. I'm vegan and I'm vegan, that's it. You know, but these are like kind of little exceptions where in this circumstance, which is very unusual, it's a beautiful thing. You know, and then you have your cow that you love so much and it gives you some milk and helps feed your family and you feed it good food, and that's a wonderful thing. But that's also such a minuscule percentage of the meat and the honey and the things that are there for the market for us to buy. That is certainly not the norm, you know. And so I guess, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. One type, I thought about raising bees because bees are in so much trouble. I wanted to save them. But then I felt, you know, it would be just as good for me, since I don't really want to be a beekeeper, is to plant lots of the different kinds of flowers that bees and the monarch butterflies love. So that they can hang out there and they can make their own hives and have plenty of organic food that's not full of pesticides and things that are actually destroying them. So that way we can contribute. In fact, in the States, there's big areas in the States where people who in their little homes, you know, with a lawn and whatnot, they plant these kind of flowers and things so that the monarch butterflies that are coming through will have somewhere to stop and be fed, because they're also going extinct. And that the bees can find a place where they can eat something that won't kill them. You know, so a lot of people are doing what they can to help save them. And I hope it's possible. How do we define mysticism? For a Western person, I think that being able to affect the future through prayers can sound mystical. In my ears, some of the things in Vedas, like prayers, can sound mystical. Yeah, maybe they are mystical. Mystical is not a bad word, though. You have to know exactly what you mean by mystical. If you start to define it, it means there are subtle laws. You know, there's physical laws, but there's also subtle laws. I mean, we know that there's plenty of subtle laws just in terms of our interpersonal relationships, because we recognize how certain types of actions will excite different types of emotions. A lot of study has been done on that. A lot of studies, too, has also been done on prayer, long-distance prayer. They've actually done empirical studies on it, at least in the States. Not hard to find. You can Google it and you can find them. And it shows that prayer is actually statistically efficacious. It's something, it does show statistically positive results. And so, to me, that makes sense, because I see that we're all living in a physical field, but we're also all living in a subtle field, you know, and we feel each other. You can be saying one thing, but you feel, you know, what's actually going on. And so there is a subtle communication that takes place. And so if you're praying for somebody, you know, that's sending a positive image with positive thoughts to that in the form of that person. And that's, I think very positive. Yeah. And sure, in the Vedas also, what do you do when, you know, like, Shiva, where are you barking at? In the Vedas, you know, there's all of these rituals that you do to, say if you're a couple and you can't have a child, so it's not working, you're not getting pregnant. There are rituals that you can do in order to facilitate that into happening, and it works also. There's so many instances of it working, and maybe I'll remember to tell you a story about it. Swamiji never used to believe in any of this, making the rains come and all of that, you know, until one day he was somewhere in the Coimbatore area, I think it was, and it was a long-term drought. It was really a problem for people sitting in summer. It's really a big problem. And so the city brought in, I don't think it was Coimbatore, but it was somewhere around there in the south. The city brought in, the people brought in some, a lot of the pujaris, you know, to do a ritual, a big ritual. They put a lot of money in, a lot of ghee, a lot of coconuts, a lot of everything. It was a big ritual that a lot of priests were involved. And the ritual was meant to bring the rains, because they hadn't had any rains. It was stone dry out and there was no water. It was awful. So it's such serious. So they did this ritual, and on the third day of the ritual, clouds formed and it poured. It poured. And Swamiji said at that time, when that happened to him, he thought, maybe there's something to this. Maybe there is something, you know, that there's some synchronicity where we're tapping into laws of the creation that are not just cause-effect on this plane, but that tap into another level of reality, like these rituals and prayers. You know, are there a certain synchronicity? Like you say this prayer and it rains. Right, what's the relationship between saying this prayer and rain? Nothing that we know. We're doing this ritual. How is this ritual going to bring about rains? I don't see any cause-effect relationship on this plane between doing a ritual and it raining. That's a synchronicity where something that's evoked on one plane brings about, you know, a change on another plane, something like that. And so, say you start having these type of synchronous experiences, synchronicities, you know that there's something more than just this physical plane that is con- that is connecting us and connecting our experiences. You can call that mystical, because it's bringing about experiences that we don't have an answer for on this physical plane. And maybe anything that does that is kind of can fall into the mystical category. Oh my goodness. Sometimes he's protecting us. Somebody said, he's only protecting us. He's only protecting us. He can't help himself. But sometimes in the middle of the night, I'll go out and say, Shiva, shh. And he just goes, Let's stop. I'm tired tonight. We'll finish these off tomorrow. Is that okay with everybody? Yeah. Let me just see.
Swasti prajapya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishaha ko brahmanebhya shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yamsho bharahitah Ramana santu nirbhayah Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritam gamaya, om purnamadha. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om
She was chanting with us. Mm-hmm. He was making the same... He was on tune part of the time. Did you notice it?